resume the hearing. We're up to day 19. We're now in COVID level 2, so if anyone's feeling under the weather of any shape or form, there's the door.
Does that apply to us?
No, you're not allowed out. We're in our own bubble. We've been cooped up together for 6 weeks. I think we're past the past needing to social distance or whether having any point in social distancing. But good that you're at a safe distance, and I suppose the only issue is be careful out there. Mr. Greaves, you're here for two clients, but first you want to talk about the maternity trust.
Yeah, if that's okay, I think we'll start with the maternity trust. As I've
absolutely
got Morgan,
as you say, so Ms. Wetherington doesn't have to listen to you warbling on about industrial zoning.
Exactly.
Exciting though that would be.
Yeah, exactly. So for those of you that don't know me, my name's Ian Greaves and I'm a planner here for the Maternity Trust and Henley Property Trust. I think to start off with, Ms. Wetherington has a short statement which she'll circulate to read, which is just a bit of an update on what has happened since the original submission and evidence was filed around maternity services in the Upper Clutha region. So, Kat. Cool, so I'll hand over to Ms. Wetherington.
Check.
Thank you.
Testing, testing.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So my name is Morgan Wetherington, and I'm a registered midwife here in Wanaka. And I'm also the chair of the newly formed charitable trust, the Upper Clutha Maternity Trust. We started this trust in response to our remote rural service dwindling. Historically, we've had 8 midwives in 2012 offering a service here in town. In 2017, we were down to 1 midwife offering a service, and we are back up with a modest improvement of 3 midwives in town. But of course, this isn't enough to run a sustainable on-call service. You need about 6 to 8 midwives to run a sustainable on-call service. That's how many people are over in Queenstown. And so we started the trust as a way to support the maternity service, which is people. So we made the submission for land and from the QLDC to build a facility that could be leased to the Southern DHB and allied professions such as well-child providers such as Plunkett to generate a little bit of income that could funnel directly into the maternity service and perhaps employing more midwives. Since we made this submission in May, there's been a number of improvements that have come from both the Ministry of Health and the Southern DHB. Both improvements make our project more sustainable. So there has been an additional funding for rural maternity coming out of the Ministry of Health, which would only encourage more midwives to come and actually puts more money into the kitty, so that would be good. And out of the Southern DHB, there is an integrated primary maternity system of care project that's rolling out at the moment. We're right in the middle of it, where the Southern DHB is looking to put primary units in more locations in our region. So there is a number of configurations that have been put forward to the community for consultation. Two of the configurations have Wanaka having a primary birthing unit, which is birthing and postnatal stay. Two of the configurations have Wanaka having a maternity hub, which is not a term that is used throughout the rest of the country. It's a Southern DHB iteration to support areas that don't have facilities, so there is support for leasing of a space and consumables, but not birth and postnatal stay. So, but regardless of how this project ends, which the we should have an answer for that in October, our Upper Clutha Maternity Trust facility can still house whatever decision the Southern DHB decides would be appropriate for this area. So it doesn't change what we what we are intending with our community trust. And that's all from me, if anybody has any questions.
The question I had, and it may alter, there may be two answers, given you what you've just told us, is approximately what sort of floor area would you, in a perfect world, and we know that life is not perfect, but in a perfect world, how much space do you actually need?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I think 400 square meters would be appropriate. We could go up. The clinical aspect could be on the bottom floor, and the administrative aspect could be on the top floor, but 400 square meters would be fine.
Just as an addendum to that, from me, sir. That's for now and future, and how far into the future will we be looking?
Yeah, so for instance, like if it was a hub and then we upgraded to a primary unit later, is that what you're thinking?
Well, I'm just, people love doing what makes babies, and we make a lot of them.
Yes.
You want to give us a lecture about how people make babies?
Right, so where are we going with projections?
No, we've got some diagrams here if you want. No.
Yeah.
If you looked at Wanaka and looked at the growth curve, how far ahead does the 400 square meters give you safety net?
Yeah, I think it would be fine in terms of, especially if there is potential to split that space. You know, initially we have 200 square meters for the maternity, 200 square meters for a well child provider. It could be those could be moved around. We would have a communal space as well in there that could be shared. So there could be the capacity to expand, but within that space, and moving other leaseholders around, if it was cleverly designed. Looking outwards, the Southern DHB, with their build in Dunedin, they don't have intentions to build a giant hospital in Cromwell in the next 10, 20 years. So regardless of what's going to happen in terms of secondary care services in the region, a primary unit here is 400 square meters would be fine.
Sweet. Thank you.
Yeah.
Commissioner Smith, any questions?
Yeah, thank you. In many ways, this is different to other bits of land because I suppose at this stage it's a council-controlled piece of land, so the ability to build on this piece of land is subject to approval from council. So in many ways, it's sort of a second safety check. We've heard from a couple of different people around the athletics. People yesterday were quite accepting of other community uses, including community hub, which was nice to hear. We've also, I suppose, potentially talked about some other community uses like maybe a youth centre or the Alpine Lakes Research Centre or, you know, and who knows what it might be in the future. I suppose do you see being able to co-locate with those types of activities?
I do. I don't know if the youth would want to co-locate with us, but we would be open to that.
A direct correlation.
There is a lot of services that we could offer within that. Toy library would be an appropriate spot to put that. Or anything early child development related would be fitting within that. Sexual health clinics would be perfect, and that could be beside the youth center. So I think that there could be. I think it has the ability, because it's family oriented, regardless of what stage the family is in, I think that there, that it would be, we could work it.
Yeah. So it seems, you know, looking at those different things and the sports activities and also the adjoining business and industrial activities, the location of these activities, these community activities in a large site seems to be the primary thing. So is that, do you think the thing we should have most concern about is where they're located in relation to other things within that large site?
So, sorry, can you phrase that again?
So I suppose you wouldn't want to necessarily have your maternity hub directly next to the industrial yard next door, for instance. You might want to be a few hundred metres along, or you wouldn't want to necessarily be in a noisy place. You might want to have good access off Ballantyne Road, for instance, or you know, you might want to have access to emergency helicopter landing. So they're the sort of things that we should consider potentially?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we could potentially be noisy as well. So it doesn't necessarily... it could be managed. Industrial sites, if there's dust and things and that.
Which equally, we might want to separate you from residential activities, for instance.
Yeah, you know, you think Charlotte Jean maternity unit down in Alexandra is in a residential area, surrounded by houses all around, and they have never had a problem with noise on their end. Yeah.
All right.
Noise complaints.
Thank you. I'm sure we'll explore that with the planner. So thank you.
Commissioner Dawson, any questions?
I presume you're having difficulty finding a site. Well, have you, I mean, can you tell us a bit about how you're going about searching for a site, the difficulties you might have had?
Yes, I was trying to remember, I've stood up at these hearings in a couple of different, over the years, in a couple of different ways. We have been looking for land for years for something like this, and of course in Wanaka it's difficult. Land is expensive, or the nature of maternity unit is not appropriate in all spaces. So it has been difficult to find land, and land that is co-located, potentially co-located with other services. For instance, you know, a house in Hikawai has been offered, but it's not necessarily an appropriate space in terms of what's surrounding there and other resources that we may need to access. So. The expense of trying to build a publicly funded service in Wanaka has been incredibly difficult.
So leasing a site from of council land is a helpful option for you.
That's right. Yeah, and you know currently we are leasing private spaces, and the money is going into those. Landlords going into the for the landlords of those private spaces. This was a way that I could see through the charitable trust model of the money from the leases going directly into the service and boosting the service as opposed to boosting profits of private landlords. So it was this was a way to benefit the actual maternity service.
Thank you,
Commissioner Monroe.
No, thank you,
Commissioner Hill.
No, thank you.
Thank you. We'll hear from Mr. Greaves.
Thank you. I presume you've got a copy of my summary?
Yes, thank you.
All right, I'll start at point two. My evidence has been prepared on behalf of the Upper Clutha Maternity Trust and relates to their submission to enable community activities at 101 Ballantyne Road. The evidence of Morgan Withington outlines current issues with maternity services in the Upper Clutha region and the need for a new maternity funding model that will be facilitated by a new maternity facility. I consider the Section 32 assessment undertaken to justify the rezoning of 101 Ballantyne Road to an active sports and recreation zone was too narrowly focused and failed to identify a sufficient range of options for this site. I consider 101 Ballantyne Road represents an appropriate location for consideration of a range of community uses, including a new maternity facility, in conjunction with sports and recreation. Under the current provisions of the ASRZ, individual activities are singled out with different resource consent categories. If an activity is not listed, then the default resource consent status is non-complying. Most community activities, including a maternity facility, would have a non-compliant status. I do not consider that this default non-compliant status is appropriate for community activities at 101 Ballantyne Road. The ASRZ zone purpose highlights community activities are anticipated in the zone, and policy 38.5.1.1 specifically provides for community activities. I've outlined that policy there. If an activity is contemplated by the objectives and policies of the plan, then there should be rules that give effect to this. As it stands, this is not the case for community activities in the ASRZ, which are foreseen by the zone purpose and policy 38.5.1. Sorry, there's actually one missing from the end of that. But given a non-complying status under this rule framework, it is my recommendation that community activities at 101 Ballantyne Road are given a permitted status. I justify this enabling status as I consider that community activities are a compatible use to co-locate with recreation uses, and given the plan foresees the establishment of community activities within the zone. I consider that the existing rule framework of the ASRZ controlling the bulk, location and size of buildings within the zone will ensure an appropriate size and scale of community buildings. The issue of reverse sensitivity effects between future activities within 101 Valentine Road can be appropriately managed by QLDC as the landowner having direct control over the location of activities across this large site. Thanks.
Mr. Greaves, like, as a philosophical issue, do you think it's appropriate to rely on the council's control of the site as the Commissioner Smith put it, should it be just a secondary constraint, and that the district plan needs to be a standalone governance model?
I accept it's relatively unique, but in some senses, I think given council will want to ensure the appropriate operation and running of the site as a whole, then I don't have concerns, and I think it can be appropriately managed in-house. I mean, effectively, in many senses, it's from most activities that are going to be undertaken on the site is potentially QLDC applying to QLDC for consents and some activities in terms of community, if you're thinking of a library or something like that. So I see where you're coming from, and it's probably what I would term the belts and braces approach. But I'm quite comfortable, particularly given you've got 20 hectares to deal with here, that it can be appropriately managed by council on its own.
The issue is not so much the internal management, but I was thinking of, but the management of effects across the boundary, particularly if the land to the south is developed for industrial purposes as it's zoned, or as recommended to be zoned. We have a recommendation that the land immediately to the north might have more of a business flavour than the notified industrial zoning. It's reverse sensitivity across the boundary that I'm interested in. Do you think where the council doesn't have quite the same dynamic to manage effects on third-party private interests?
Yeah, look, I think, and that's a fair point, and I think there would be an appropriate mechanism to deal with that, maybe an additional setback applied to the zone provisions for community uses. I guess the next question is, what should that setback be? I think as an example of separation between residential activities and industrial uses, and I'm looking at the plan behind you on the map, is the buffer zone between the rear of Ballantyne Ridge and Willow Ridge's residential land to the south. And I, off the top of my head, being involved in that many years ago, I think that setback's 20 metres, that buffer zone. So that would be, I think, yes, it is an issue, and I wouldn't have concern about applying a specific or bespoke 20-metre setback requirement, which I think would alleviate a lot of those concerns.
Thank you, Mr. Greaves. Commissioner Smith.
Yeah, thank you. We touched on, I suppose, location being the key, so, and the setback issue, I think, is evident of that. And, look, there's going to be a whole range of things that would determine the best location on this site for any community activity. I'm just trying to work out the best mechanism to control the location of these activities. I mean, would a restricted discretionary activity where the discretion is limited to location, hazardous materials, for instance, because we know there's some contaminated sites, effects on neighbours, something like that. Would that work?
Yes and no. I think the issue, though, is the location of a community activity across the site needs to be considered in recognition of how the whole site's going to work in practice going forward.
Yep.
So if let's say, the maternity facility was the first cab off the rank, and I think it's more appropriate that it, you know, it's almost sits in the Parks and Reserves team to actually consider how they want the site as a whole, considering all uses, potential future uses. Because the issue would be if you lodge a consent as a restricted discretionary activity for a maternity facility to the council planning department, but no consideration by the Parks and Reserves team has been considered to actually how that's going to work, then actually that resource consent process is really sort of...
Potentially that's the overlap between what the chair was talking about, between council's other functions and the resource management functions. I mean, you know, clearly, as you say, the reserves team would want to understand a site master plan or something before they issued a
list. But I think that's more important than a resource consent, to be fair. And that's why actually that side of it, I think, is actually better managed through the outside the RMA regulatory process and actually in-house.
So you've recommended either, I think, a permitted or a controlled activity. What control over location would that give us as you've recommended?
My recommendation is permitted. And that's, I guess, I mean, when you look at what the purpose of a resource consent is, it's put in place to manage potential effects, avoid effects, mitigate effects. And in this case, and on this particular site, I don't believe that community activities will generate a level of effects that need to be managed or controlled by a resource consent, particularly with that other level of input.
And what about consideration of the opposite, the reverse sensitivity?
Well, yeah, but I think that can be managed by a standard within the plan.
Right. And so, regard to these rules, you know, clearly the open space recreation zones, active sport recreation zones, not only cover this site, but a whole range of sites in the district. Is this provision for community facilities something we should just apply to this site, or something across the board?
I think that's a scope issue.
And potentially it's a scope issue. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it only can apply to the site because we're not, yeah, I don't think the other, yeah, exactly.
Okay, so we're dealing with this bespoke thing. And going to those range of community activities, have you got a view on how we define what, I mean, you know, community activities are a pretty broad thing. Do we need to confine or constrain the type of community activities in any way?
Well, community activity is defined by the plan, and
what do we?
It's super broad.
Or do we rely on what is acceptable to the community through the council's control of the site?
Look, in my evidence, I did address. I guess my starting point for this was potentially you just add in an additional rule which provides for maternity facilities. But when I got thinking about it, and look, that would, I guess, resolve the, that would tick the box for the maternity trust in terms of the site. But when I actually thought about it, I thought, well, we've got 20 hectares here. We've got a piece of land where there's evidence to suggest we don't need all of it for sports facilities, which I addressed around that 32 assessment. So I think there's a real potential for the site to actually offer that wider positive benefits for a range of community activities. Yes, you might be right. There may be some that would potentially be inappropriate on that site, but I guess that is the reality of the situation that they, again, it's a council-controlled site, and it's unlikely, let's say, a courthouse is ever going to potentially pop up or establish there.
With those ones, community activities that would be inappropriate, would they conflict with the other uses of the site, or would they conflict with the adjoining uses? So is it something, once again, that is...
My view is, I'm just running through the definition of community activities as we're talking, I'm relatively comfortable that all types of community activities would be appropriate to co-locate with the recreation uses there.
All right, thank you for that. You acknowledge that it is a big site, and you know equally the shape of sports fields may leave some land that's not usable for additional sport fields.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Commissioner Dawson.
When you look at the activities that are provided for in the zone at the moment, I can see what you mean about anything that's not listed just gets bundled into the non-complying activity status. And some community activities have been singled out already, like community centres and halls is a discretionary activity. Daycare facilities would come within community activities. It's discretionary. Art galleries, libraries, non-complying. Art galleries, discretionary, cultural centres. So is it your submission that those activities that are already listed as some form of activity status would, in this site, be bundled up into a permitted activity status?
Correct.
And does your scope of the submission cover that?
Yes.
So it says all community facilities, activities, at the site would be changed.
I read that, you say,
okay. And you're satisfied that daycare facilities, police stations, what else is there? Fire stations, probation centres, all these activities could be accommodated as a permitted activity in the resource management sense on the site, and that the district council under its ownership would decide who goes there and who doesn't go there, whether a school can go there or not, whether a daycare centre or not, and where and how they relate to the recreation activities on the site. They're leaving quite a lot of decisions to the Queenstown Lakes as landowner.
Yeah, and I accept that, and I guess that it comes down to whether, as a commissioner panel, you're comfortable that I think in reality the likelihood is that there won't be a lot of community activities that are established here, because through that process there will be a select few, hopefully including a maternity facility, that are established there. But we've got 20 hectares, and that is what gives me comfort that there can be that control outside this regulatory process.
Well, it certainly does seem scope for more than what's permitted at the moment, which is nothing.
Really. Exactly.
Despite the policy, as you say. Thank you very much.
Commissioner Monroe.
Thank you. Yes. Degrees on. I understand everything you've said. What I've taken from your evidence is that the issue is a philosophical or quasi-legal one of saying, if you don't need to regulate something, why do it? And I just want to test that with you. Let's assume your client's activity is proposed as a non-complying activity under the provisions of the zone as notified.
Mm-hmm.
You've already identified a degree of policy support,
yep.
Struggling to see how it would possibly be credibly held as being contrary to the plan as a whole.
Agree.
Struggling to see that there'd be an argument that there's any effects more than minor that's effectively equivalent or comparable to a club room or something similar. Issues of reverse sensitivity plainly can be managed. I'm not understanding any scenario where what I've heard from your client faces any real-world jeopardy to a battle-hardened practitioner like you in the context of a resource concern. So what I want to test with you is it just as simple as don't regulate something if you don't need to, or is there more to it from your client's perspective? Sometimes we hear that organisations can't get funding if they can't demonstrate a slam-dunk permitted type use. Is there an issue of there's just not physical means to pay for the cost of the consent? Is there something like that, or is it just as simple as don't regulate if you don't need to?
I think it's a bit of both. I 100% agree with what you're saying. I think if, in terms of a resource consent process, the policy framework, the effects can all be managed. And I can sit here right now and be quite confident that consent would be granted. I agree with that. But the issue I see in terms of a resource consent process is, in this district in particular, it's time-consuming, it's costly. Often you need an army of consultants to justify an application, even when a plan signals it's inappropriate, but the rules don't reflect this. So I think that's...
Based on your experience, what would you estimate it might cost your applicant to actually put together a convincing non-compliant resource consent application for 1 month?
Let's work through the issues for the site. I think at the end of the day, you'd need a planning assessment. You've got some contaminated land, so you potentially need to deal with that. So you've got a land contamination consultant involved, potentially traffic and parking. So let's just use those three consultants probably as the three core group. At the end of the day, I think those three consultants plus council fees, ballpark $20,000.
Oh, wow. You're lucky you're not in Auckland.
Excuse me, let's not put a lot in Auckland.
And that's a lot of money for a charitable trust. They don't have that money.
For a midwife.
Exactly. And I think that's the core issue. Why, if the plan signals the activity, why require that?
Yeah, no, I understand all that. Thank you, Mr. Greaves.
Commissioner McLeod.
I have fully read your evidence, fully can neither confirm nor deny support or otherwise. My major concern is, under the definition of community facilities, you could be sharing this facility, potentially if it went ahead, with a council office. Are you comfortable with that? That's fine, I have no question.
Michelle?
If youth can do it, you guys can do it. Come on.
Thank you. I think that the issues have been covered, but I understand your concern. You've got a zone which appears quite enabling in terms of that community activity, but with a broad definition. So I understand the issues. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's all I have too.
Thank you.
And so thank you, Ms. Weir.
Thank you.
Free to go.
You thanks.
Can exit. Good luck. Stay right.
Thanks, you guys.
I think for that's an easy one. To deal with this industrial zone.
Thank you. Thanks, Ian.
No worries.
The amount you have to pay for masks.
Little line in advance.
Okay.
Council Mark, we'll get $100 for masks.
Thank you. We'll catch up soon.
Oh, I'm supposed to go to Wellington for a meeting on Monday night, Tuesday. So just emailing. Well, no, because it's going to come. No, we do normally. So this is about once a year. AGM.
Mr. Greaves.
All right, we'll move on to.
I think we know who you are now.
Yeah, cool. We'll move on to the industrial zone. I'll keep this one hopefully relatively short. So I'm here today, my evidence has been prepared on behalf of the Henley Property Trust and relates to their submission on the proposed general industrial zone. My evidence focuses on the provision of ancillary office space and trade supply businesses in the zone. I do not support the proposed 50 square metre threshold for ancillary office space stipulated in Rule 18A.5.1. I consider the size of ancillary office space should reflect the overall size of the associated industrial building rather than an arbitrary number set at 50 square metres. I consider a rule framework that sets a 30% GFA percentage for ancillary office space to be more appropriate. I justify this threshold by providing examples of recently approved industrial buildings in the general industrial zone and providing an analysis of similar rule frameworks used in other districts. 50 square metre office threshold runs the risk of industrial businesses splitting up industrial activities from their office activities that would result in an inefficient use of land and resources, could compromise productivity and efficiency, and result in increased movements between vehicle movements between multiple premises. I consider that trade supply businesses should be a permitted activity in the general industrial zone. I'm of the opinion that the amended planning framework for trade supply businesses set out in Council's Section 42A report does not offer a suitable solution to the issue. I consider accurately determining what represents an appropriate trade supply business for the zone based on a resource consent process that assesses the predicted ratio of wholesale customers versus retail customers to be problematic. A permitted status reflects the trade supply businesses tend to have a genuine link to the industrial and service sectors and will result in positive economic benefits for the wider district. Happy to take questions.
Mr. Greaves, can I ask you a question about the last point, trade suppliers?
Yeah.
I think the concern is not with the low-level trade supplier, it's with the Mitre 10 mega Bunnings model, which takes up a colossal area of, if allowed, of industrial land, has a huge car park, and is dragging people in from all over the show. How do you, as compared to the plumbing supplier that has a 300 square metre building, might have the odd individual coming in for a tap fitting, but is really supplying the tradies. So there's a colossal spectrum between the two.
Understood.
How do you manage that spectrum?
I think the simple answer to that question is a large Mitre 10 mega would fit the definition of large format retail, which has a separate regulatory process currently prohibited, although I understand that there may be some concerns around that, and that would flip into potentially non-complying. And I think the threshold off the top of my head is 500 square metres for it to be large format retail.
Does an activity that comes within the definition of trade supplier, in other words, it's a mixture of wholesaling and retailing, does it automatically flick into being a large format retailer if it exceeds 500 square metres?
That would be my understanding, because it is based on that floor area ratio, so it would be an additional level of control. I haven't gone back and looked at... No, it's not clear. It would be a worthwhile exercise to have a look at, say, some of those Frankton consents, how they are being dealt with, but I'm pretty confident they were considered large format retail.
Even though they come within the definition of trade supplier. Anyway, thank you.
Yes, in an earlier stage of the proposed district plan, I heard submissions from Bunnings who were very keen to have a definition of trade supplier on the basis that they were neither one thing nor the other. They weren't a retailer.
Right.
And that was what they were pursuing.
Were they successful?
I think there is a definition of trade supplier now.
Yes.
I mean, large format retail says a single retail tenancy. So if you are a mixture of retail and wholesale, you might be able to argue that you just come within the trade supplier definition.
There's no definition, I think. There is a definition for wholesale, but it's relative only to the airport zone, I think. I specifically reviewed the definition of the large format retail, and it would be my opinion that a Mitre 10 mega would fit that definition. I can't see how it couldn't. Otherwise, you're only really dealing with supermarkets then.
table one, you've got a table of warehouse floor area, office floor. Is there an argument that a warehouse will have different office needs to a true industrial operation? I don't know what those needs would be, but is there an argument that it might be different?
I think all businesses probably have different administration or office requirements, and probably, to be honest, that the table and the use of the term warehouse has probably just actually come from the architectural plans, but in reality the buildings or the examples that I provided are consented for both warehouse or manufacturing operations. There is a restriction which was to do with the car park, or the limitation on car parking to how much manufacturing could operate within the building, but those buildings can or are consented to be used for both warehousing and manufacturing.
Mr. Hill.
Thank you. Can I just focus on the 50-metre threshold for ancillary? And I was looking at Mr. Place's rebuttal where he says that he remains open to considering amendments to the rule, essentially based on evidence and why mm-hmm. it might need to be larger. Can you just set out, from your understanding, of his view is he'd rather stick to a number, a percentage number, rather than sort of a percentage in GFA on evidence. So why does it necessarily follow, I don't know this, so I'm asking the question, why does it necessarily follow that a larger premises would need larger offices? What actually is the particular circumstances in buildings which would mean the office needs to be a percentage size of the activity?
Good question, and I have to, I guess, admit that I'm no expert specifically on industrial activities, but it would be my opinion that the larger the business, the larger the manufacturing space, the larger the likely need for more administration or office staff. And yesterday when I was doing a bit of pre-work for this hearing, I thought of a couple of larger industrial premises that aren't based in this district, and one of them is actually Calder Stewart in Milton, and it's a manufacturing factory which I've actually been to in the past, and I've been to their office premises there, and it's huge. So I actually went on Google Earth yesterday and I just very crudely and roughly measured the size of their office space, and it's about 2,500 square metres, very roughly. That's definitely not an accurate figure. And I think that gives a good example. And then their manufacturing space is probably four times that, sort of 10,000 square metres. And in my mind, you know, if a company like Calder Stewart decided that setting up an operation in Wanaka was a positive outcome for their business, we should be encouraging and enabling that, not limiting it. And I think a 50 square metre threshold in the context of that office space is just, it's far too small.
You listen to the hearings yesterday, I've made some very similar comments for Calder Stewart specifically.
Right.
Diversifying our economy and,
There we go.
So the follow-up question I have to, follow-up question to that is, the general theme of the submissions to the general industrial zone is that it's too restrictive. But put that aside for a moment, if the zone comes through largely in that form, who knows, is it your view that because offices, it's ancillary to the primary activity and not an independent office, therefore it doesn't matter what size it is?
Correct, and I think that's the critical issue. I'm not sitting here encouraging or suggesting that independent offices not associated with the industrial activity are appropriate in the zone. There is other zones where they are more appropriate, but I think the provisions of the plan need to be much more enabling to recognise that. In my mind, the 50 square metre was just an arbitrary number, and there was no justification for that. And where I got to through the examples I've dealt with in the past and looking at some other plans was, in my opinion, was the 30% seemed like an appropriate threshold that allowed for an appropriate level of potential office space for any size business.
Thank you. Then my final question then, if it is truly to be ancillary and the primary activity is the actual industrial activity, does any size need to be included at all? And it would need to be left over to the owner of that factory, because presumably, if they made it all office, then it clearly doesn't fit the general industrial zone.
And that's the exact scenario that is currently in place for the industrial B zone of the ODP, and that's in terms of those three examples I gave, was the planning provisions that they were assessed under. My view is potentially the PDP policy framework might be a little bit more prescriptive in terms of, I think particularly look at policy, I think it's 3.38, pretty prescriptive in terms of that avoidance policy, so that in my mind probably gives a steer that there needs to be some level of control, and my view is the 30% is the appropriate threshold.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr.
Commissioner McLeod.
Yep, thank you very much, Mr. Bruce, for your evidence. It was very clear, very well laid out, and I valued the other examples of different. Just one question, which is, does ancillary 2 require a definition?
It's a good question. I actually looked at the Cambridge Dictionary definition yesterday.
Well,
just
we had a whole hearing
there's
on
not
that
one
in
there.
Christchurch.
Right. And I wrote it down as providing support or help was the what
See,
I took from that.
I got providing necessary support to the primary activities or operation of.
Very similar, correct. I guess the answer to that question is how far or how many definitions do you need to include in the plan, and I think that's one example where you could probably rely on a dictionary definition to give you the answer, so I'm comfortable that it doesn't sit in the plan. And it's probably another question, is there scope to add that in terms of this process, which possibly there isn't.
Potentially a process. Question I can ask of the chair. Thank you,
Commissioner Munro.
Thank you,
Ms. Dawson.
Just a couple of questions. I think you've acknowledged, Commissioner Hill, anyway, that some form of size limit is more consistent with the policy, because I mean the word ancillary does lend itself to arguments from time to time. So
I accept that.
Yes. That you know what is ancillary and what is not, can, and if you're just relying on that. One of the suggestions at the time we were talking to the council officers, and I noticed it's in some of the plans, is a sort of either-or type rule on terms of square meterage or percentage. And I'm not thinking of 50 square metres. It would need to be a bigger number. I think in the discussion with the council officers, there was a concern that if you just had a percentage, it just could get bigger and bigger and bigger without any upper limit to set the point where an application is required.
And so would that be, for example, 30% or 500 square metres?
Yeah, that's what Christchurch has, I noticed.
Yeah, right. 30, yep.
Whichever is the lesser
yep.
as the trigger. I mean, is there any benefit in that, or is it...
I go back to that Court of Stewart example, and my initial reaction to that is a business of that size or scale, which is truly an industrial activity, there'll be no argument there. What are we trying to limit, or what are we trying to protect by potentially restricting their establishment if they do truly have, which it looks like. So my reaction to that is I am very comfortable that it can just be dealt with as a percentage of the overall business.
All right, thank you.
Commissioner Smith.
Yeah, thank you. And I suppose that runs to a similar question is, you know, presumably we want all activities to have a home in the suite of zones that we have, and you know, you've touched on Calder Stewart, and as I said, I used that specific example the other day. If we are deliberately trying to diversify our economy, we need a home for the types of activities we want to attract.
Exactly.
And a national base for a commercial company would, you know, presumably create a lot of jobs.
Exactly.
I take your point about providing a home for them in the industrial activities. I suppose what I've been exploring with a number of the other planners is where is the gap between business mixed use and general industrial, and is there actually a gap in between those in terms of providing for particularly service related activities and vehicle based retail activities, those sort of things? Is there a gap there?
Yeah, I think there is, and to be honest, I haven't looked at the business mixed use zone in detail recently, but my understanding of the business mixed use zone, it's definitely a zone which is transitioning to more of a high amenity urban type zone, which I think off the top of my head, industrial activities are non-complying in the business mixed use zone, but it's very much in a transitioning zone to the residential visitor accommodation amenities, there are activities that are now anticipated in that zone. So I think there is quite a clear distinction of sort of those heavy traffic movements or noise, dust that should be encouraged to the industrial zone to allow. And look, the business mixed use zone as it stands today, in terms of if you look at Anderson Heights, it's definitely in no sense established to its full potential around what that zone allows for and what that zone's seeking to achieve. So I think we need to be careful not to assume that what's currently in that zone is actually what the zone will look like in the future.
An expression of the zone, yeah. So, if you take large office buildings, for instance, I mean, where should they fit?
Well, that would be the business mixed-use zone. An independent office building would be business mixed-use zone. Town centre zone as well, although it would need to be retail on the ground floor. And then there's obviously Three Parks business zone, which is going to business mixed use, majority of it. And then there's obviously the question around the industrial zone there. So, yeah, I'm only talking Wanaka here. Obviously, so Queenstown's different.
So the question, ultimately, I suppose, is, what you're suggesting is in some ways a bit of a softening of the general industrial zone, which I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but you're saying that the provisions sort of soften that to bring it this way a little bit. Should we actually be trying to soften the general industrial zone, or should we keep that discreetly for hard industrial activities? And actually, is there something in the middle that we should be placing in there? And we had a discussion yesterday about the provisions of the 19. A chapter, which is the Three Parks business zone, which was an additional zone that was suggested through the section 42A. Is that actually the thing that sort of fits in the middle? That's more similar to the old industrial A provisions.
I don't know the ins and outs of that new Three Parks zone, so I'm not comfortable commenting on that.
So conceptually, do you think we should be softening the industrial zone or providing something to fill the gap in between?
Well, I think that it's too restrictive at the moment, is my answer to that question. But how far you go is probably the...
And so just one last question. In your experience, is it the general industrial zone has a number of prohibited activities.
Mm-hmm.
Is that an unusual approach in our district plan?
Yeah, that's a wider issue, I guess, which is a little bit beyond this submission. But my planning opinion on that is there's no justificational basis for the level of prohibited activities that council's proposed. I think a non-complying status with the policy and objective framework currently in place provides a sufficient safeguard for some of the issues that council was concerned about.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greaves.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time. Next submitter on the schedule is Mr. Barton. Seems to be a deafening silence. So, Ms. Stephen.
ended up, was supposed to have two, and I'm not sure whether Mr. Angus is, has managed to join, or whether you're just showing one at a time.
He says he is.
I'm here.
That's Ray, Ray, and then we've got our economist. Jeff? Yes. Ah, right, okay.
Can everyone hear me all right?
Yes, thanks. Loud and clear, Ray.
Okay. I'm here.
Yep.
Yep.
Can you hear me? Yep, I can hear you guys fine. Can you hear me?
Yeah, just, we'll come to you soon, Ray.
Remain patient.
Jeff, are you able to hear me?
Yes.
I can hear you. Can you hear me? Yep.
I can hear you too.
Yep, I can see you.
Okay.
Run and you and I.
And we'll wave when we want you to talk.
Yeah. So, Ms. Stephen, you,
yes, I think
you have the floor.
Okay, thank you. I've filed written submissions. We have three witnesses here today, this morning, and we've got Mr. Milne calling in this afternoon. Because Mr. Giddens is going to be reliant upon Mr. Milne's evidence, Mr. Milne has pre-circulated his summary, so I hope you've received that.
Yes, thank you.
That was filed with some graphic attachments. I only want to speak before I hand over to the witnesses. I just want to touch on two or three points raised in my original my submissions, but I would like the opportunity to comment at the end if we don't run out of time. And the first point to note is that in my opening submissions, I had referred to the relief that was being sought by Cardona Cattle Company, and that had included a suite of, well, obviously the general industrial zone and a suite of changes to the zone, which isn't complete, and Mr. Giddens is going to speak to that. There have been some further modifications to address primarily landscape issues, amongst other things, and Mr. Giddens will speak to those. But also in relation to the this controversial question of whether an urban growth boundary is a permissible amendment in terms of Clause 10.2, which allows consequential changes. And I guess the key point that I want to make is that having reflected further on the implications of Mr. Milne's evidence, it's our first position that an urban growth boundary is a not critical relief.
Say again.
It's not critical relief. The assessment that Mr. Milne has undertaken is that the general industrial zone over the land would lead to development that on his assessment, looking at firstly the landscape values of the existing site and then the extent and manner of, to which that would change by a developed zone, would not exhibit urban development characteristics in terms of the definition of urban development. So on that basis, it has been decided that the urban growth boundary isn't critical relief. And so that's a modification of the relief sought in the original submission and in the evidence. But the we're not withdrawing those submissions because the panel may come to a different view, and I remain of the view that an urban growth boundary is a permissible consequential change. And even though that's not something that's being actively pursued anymore, I just want to speak very briefly to that. And you'll see in my submissions, I have made the point that the necessary first question is whether the land is in its location, the characteristics of the land make it suited to industrial use. You can't just draw an urban boundary around land without having given some consideration to what type of urban development would be appropriate on that land. And you know, this is not the situation, as in Christchurch, where we have an urban growth boundary depicted on a map in an RPS, and you're stumped if, at the district plan level, you ask for an urban development urban zone and you haven't, you're not within the urban boundary under the RPS. But even where those urban limits are identified on the map in the RPS, that follows a more finely grained assessment of the suitability of the greenfield sites that are indicated within that boundary for particular types of urban development, whether it's in residential, business, industrial. So that's that point. The second point that I want to speak to relates to, I'm not going to get down to the nitty-gritty of the evidential matters. I want to briefly address the submission of scope, and I've had a heads up that I'm going to be given the opportunity to comment in writing on the sort of the on the plan change scope issue that's raised in the submissions filed by scope, which is somewhat surprising. And I think Commissioner Dawson, you'll be aware that this sort of issue in general was raised at the hearings on the Christchurch District Plan, whether you know, if you didn't submit request of rezoning from rural to something that came later in the proceedings, you know, which order. And I think that it, in this case, I don't think that the case law on scope is a tidy fit with the way in which the council has promoted its plan review here. It's done that in stages, but the intention is that the whole plan be reviewed. And so I think that you have to look at that scope issue in that context. There could have been a submission at stage one challenging the suitability of the rural zone, but we wouldn't get very far with it if you didn't have the GIZ zone provisions in front of you to enable a consideration of the suitability of the site for a development of the kind contemplated by that zone. You can only do that now when we have those zone provisions before us. So in simple terms, I don't think that there's anything in that argument that is now being raised by scope. The other point that I want to make about the scope submission, they're a trade competitor, and I think you know the panel's made a determination that they're not constrained by the matters that they can raise as a further submitter, and I simply make the point that they doesn't take away from the fact that they are a trade competitor. So the submissions and the evidence, I think, should be sort of tempered by that commercial reality. They are the owner of the only undeveloped industrial block of land within the Rokitapu ward at Kainbin. And I would urge you to treat the submissions and the evidence with a degree of caution on the grounds that I say it's inclined to exaggerate the likelihood that reverse sensitivity effects will arise. And I want to make the point that whenever you're considering reverse sensitivity, it has to be understood you have to have an appreciation of the level of adverse effects that incumbent activity is able to generate. And if you look at the constraints on the operation of the land for activities under the designation, and more particularly in terms of their discharge permits, and take those into account, there's a dissipating level of adverse effects. At the boundary of the buffer, they're to be no more than minor. At the boundary of the landfill site, odour in particular is not allowed to be offensive and objectionable. I also want to make the point, and I think it sort of stems from the fact that at the hearing last week on the consent application, the commissioners undertook a site visit of the Scope landfill. And I don't know whether you're intending to do that, but at the moment, they're in the process of putting in place their gas capture system, which is required under NES, the standards, and it is more odorous now. And they've openly admitted that in the application that they lodged with ORC, that they won't be able to comply with their pre-existing discharge permit conditions while that system is being put in place. But by the time that is fully commissioned, which has to be by December this year, odour levels will reduce. So whatever impression is formed about odour on the site now, that is not the long-term situation. Well, it's not the permissible level of odour beyond December 2020 at the latest. The other point that I want to make about the scope submission, and I've addressed it in my legal submissions, is this notion that the buffer zone is, there are a whole bunch of activities that are prohibited, and that it's supposed to be set aside as an area of land where nothing but rural activity occurs, just to keep people out of the zone so that there are no complaints. And that is not correct. I've described the zone as somewhat of a hollow zone because there is no zone description, there are no restrictions. I've referred to the Mail plan change application site, and again, Commissioner Dawson will be very familiar with that. That's where there were controls through the designation and in the underlying zone provisions. Nothing like that exists here, irrespective of what the initial intentions were. In the rezoning package, it is notable that the rules that are being proposed would, to some extent, fill that gap. And there would be prohibitions on the more sensitive activities. The buffer site would be set aside for the more noxious industrial activities provided for under the zone, which are probably more space intensive and with fewer number of persons occupying the site. And there is also a proposal to offer an easement. And I gave you an example where an easement has been proposed next to a landfill, and I think that was where residential activity was going to be established on the adjoining site. So the overall package that is being promoted here, it will give the councillors requiring authority a higher level of protection than they currently enjoy. And save for making further comments at the end, I just want to hand over to the witnesses, unless you have any questions for me right now, which I'm happy to ask.
I did have some questions, thank you, Stephen. Firstly, talking about odour and the material you've produced, I got a little puzzled. As I understand it, the odour or the gas capture is capturing methane. Mr. Rissington, or Dr. Rissington, I'm not sure which, is talking about hydrogen sulphide, which is a different source of odour. So is the, like, I understand the point that we might get an atypical impression where we walk on the site right now because of what they're doing with gas capture, but does that issue address the hydrogen sulphide or the potential for hydrogen sulphide emissions, which is, as far as I'm aware, a completely separate...
A different source of odour.
Different source of odour.
I say it makes no difference whatsoever, and the simple reason is that the discharge permit regulates odour irrespective of the source. And it has to be managed so that it's not offensive or objectionable beyond the boundary of the site, regardless of you know, the source of that odour. And I'm basing the submissions that I made on the content of the assessment of effects that accompanied the application lodged last year for the installation of this gas capture system, which said that the odour levels will be such that we won't be able to comply with those existing conditions. Whether it's because of the gas source that you've just referred to or not is irrelevant. It's because it's the total emission, odour emission, that's captured and that's got to be managed in order to achieve compliance with that consent. So that is the basis upon which I make that submission. It's taking words from the Tonkin and Taylor assessment itself. It said that we won't comply with those pre-existing conditions. We will be able to once it's completely installed. They revert back to their pre-existing discharge permit, which will continue to regulate their activities until it's replaced. But even so, the Tonkin and Taylor assessment was that even during this installation period, the effects would be no more than minor, and no one on the adjoining sites is adversely affected, and nor is public notification justified. So I'm just basing it upon the assessment. And I guess my point is that that is a benchmark or a baseline against which to view the evidence that you'll hear at this hearing, which is that we're going to be very noisy, people on very odorous, people on adjoining sites are likely to be adversely affected to a significant extent. It raises issues with the credibility of the statements made in the original AEE. And that's as far as I can take it, really. I'm just using their assessment.
I understand. I understand also your point about having shifted ground. While I was looking forward to asking Mr. Giddens how he managed to categorise Victoria Flat as a settlement, you're taking your stand now, as I understand it, on the fact that Mr. Milne's assessment is that this is not urban development. Mm-hmm. The fact remains, however, that the GIZ is an urban zone.
Is it defined anywhere as an urban design though?
Well, that's...
I've been looking for definitions in the plan.
It does sit in a section of the plan called
yes.
urban environment.
Yes. Yeah. And so the... Is the test... So the punchline question is the test a planning test, about, as I say, whether it's an urban zone, or a test of what's on the ground, and is that urban development?
Well, I think the urban development definition necessarily contemplates that it's based upon an assessment of the character of what's on the ground. It's probably got a combination of elements, but overall, that is the overriding of that definition. It's differentiated from rural development by its scale, intensity, visual character, and the dominance of built structures. And so it necessarily is based upon an assessment of the character. And
do you agree that that's an assessment of the character of the development itself?
Yes.
Distinct from an assessment of the effects of that development in its wider environment?
Well, I don't think you can. I don't think you can separate out the. I mean. Are you making a distinction? And I had this discussion with Mr. Giddens earlier. You can make a distinction between the characteristics of an activity, and I'll just take rural industrial activity that's defined. And so you can just look at the characteristics of that activity, and it doesn't have to be site-specific. Obviously, it's just the inherent characteristics of that activity which will bring it within the definition or not. But when you're looking at the character of a developed site, which I think this definition, urban development, invites, you have to look at the characteristics of the development on the land, because scale, you can't just look at the inherent attributes of the character without looking at it on its side. I think that's my answer.
Ms. Stephen, Commissioner has asked for a brief interlude. We're adjourned for 5 minutes.
Oh, right. Thank you.
Actually, if it's okay, in terms of what you can... productively do in the break. I've got some questions for you. I haven't been able to find in the material anything like an estimate of how much GFA the relief requested might actually lead to, what kind of traffic might be generated. Those are also matters in the definition. You may have them to hand, but you could think about finding those for the questions I'll ask you when we come back.
Well, I can tell you that my witnesses are going to address that.
Oh, they will? Okay,
yes,
that's fine.
Yes, I prefer to leave it to the witnesses.
So, 5 minutes. Thank you.
Perfect, thanks.
Thank you.